starting point, isn't it?
It sounds like.
Yeah. So I'm Robert from Fish and Franks, and this week in fishing, we've got Josh Olive.
He did it again.
The man of many hats.
Captain Josh. You just can't get used to it, can you?
No. Plus, you know how highly I think about some of that stuff with titles.
I know.
And we got Joe here sitting controlling the radio station here because RJ has other things to do today.
He's busy.
KDW in Northport.
He's an extremely important man.
All right. So, little update on the shop. Let's see. Things are going along pretty good. We had some issues with our shrimp tanks. Hopefully got those straightened out. Frank and I were there until 1 o'clock in the morning the other night. Draining, stripping, cleaning, all that good stuff on the tanks. It was awesome. But now our shrimp seem to be staying alive a little bit better. Shrimp sizes have gone down the last couple weeks, which has been really strange. I mean, they went from 18-pounders down to 12-pounders, and now they're down to, like, 8-pounders.
Well, I don't know. An 8-pound shrimp still sounds pretty big to me.
Yeah, no. That's the size weight for 1,000 shrimp.
Ah, okay.
So they've gone down significantly in size. We're getting in product slowly all the time. We've gotten in some new Berkeley stuff. I don't even know what else. We've gotten in a bunch of different new lures lately. We just finally got in an order today, actually right before we left, was from Zebco Quantum. So we got some combos and some reels coming in from them. And then there's a dozen other boxes of miscellaneous stuff back there that I'm sure we'll get out there eventually out onto the floor. But every day, a little bit more coming in, a little bit more getting put on the floor. Still, some stuff is extremely hard to get. Gentlemen in today looking for small circle hooks and big circle hooks, and hooks are still one of the hardest things to get, no matter what brand you like.
Right. And, of course, if your favorite brand of tackle is made in Ukraine, well, you might have an issue for a little while. So.
Yeah, that could be a big issue for a while. So it's slowly getting there, but it's worth coming in every week and just wandering around, checking it out, and seeing what actually finally came in. It's been kind of nice. It's been like Christmas regularly. But can't make everybody happy, but we're doing our darndest. And the cool part is we've got a lot of new people in this area that are coming in, asking questions, wanting to learn. It's been really awesome.
Yes, it's a great and terrible thing to constantly have new people moving here and wanting to learn how to do, what to do, where to do, all that stuff. You know, it's great to see the enthusiasm and to be able to teach, and then you just sit back and notice how many new people are here.
Right.
So, yeah, you know, upsides, downsides.
Yeah, sometimes it's a little overwhelming, but it's pretty awesome. I mean, that's the best part about the job is being able to teach people what they're doing and how to do it. Makes it a lot easier sometimes.
You just like bossing people around.
No. Yeah, that's got me all over it. Oh, geez.
So what do you want to talk about today? You want to do current events, politics, religion, or just talk fishing?
I think we should just talk fishing.
Okay, that sounds like a plan.
Because sometimes that crap spills over anyway.
It does. I mean,
they had all those big to-do meetings up there in Tallahassee about the clean water and all that junk, which people have been asking about. But I just suggested they go look it up and see what it was all about.
Listen,
because they've been such a hodgepodge of different events going on with that from several different entities.
If you want to know, just go to the Captains for Clean Water website. You know, listen, those types of organizations, they have their positives and they have their negatives. But really, Captains for Clean Water is staying on top of what's going on with this.
Yeah.
So if you want to know, then go check them out. They'll keep you as informed as you want to be and maybe a little bit more so.
Right. And it seems like they're doing a pretty good job of what they're trying to accomplish. But I think ultimately, and we all want clean water. We all want better fishing. We all want that. So, I mean, the best thing I can tell anybody is when you go out fishing or if you live on a canal or you're fishing in a boat or from shore, you should always come back with more trash than you left with. You know, there's no reason not to.
Right. It's a start anyway.
Yeah.
Something that you can do.
Yeah. I mean, I live right on a saltwater canal. We've got a 5-gallon bucket right there next to the dock and two different nets for scooping stuff up as it floats down the canal.
Now, there's a difference between clean water and clear water. And clear water is something that we're experiencing out there right now.
Totally different entity.
You can't tell from looking at it what kind of nutrient pollution it may have in it, but it is beautiful water to look at.
Oh, yeah. And it's frustrating people because they're like, I can see fish, but I can't get them to eat.
Yeah.
That would be why.
It's a little bit of a challenge when the fish can see you back.
Yeah.
And they can see your bait, they can see your hook, they can see your line, and they can see it's connected to that weird-looking heron standing on the shore.
Right.
So it all does make it a little bit more tricky.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. And everyone asks, well, what's the benefits of braided line versus monofilament? And then they ask, why should I use fluorocarbon over a monofilament leader? And it's hard to give them a definitive answer because there really isn't a solid solution to that, because all of them have their pros and cons to them.
Right. And the big con, of course, to braided line when you have clear water, and we're talking about that, is that it's extremely visible on the water. And you have a lot of people who think they've solved that problem by going to a dark-colored braided line because they cast it out and they can't see it anymore. But they're not thinking about what a fish sees and how a fish is looking upwards through the water at your line, which is very starkly contrasting with the bright sky. It's extremely easy for those fish to see that line that you're thinking is completely invisible laying out there.
Right. Yeah. Braid line, it's a solid object in the water no matter what color it is. So I think in this clearer water, the biggest difference that I would do with the braid line is just use a much longer leader.
And a longer leader, it will help you a lot, as long as you're using a longer leader made of the right materials.
Correct.
A longer wire leader is not going to help you very much.
No.
A longer piece of monofilament, well, that's better. Monofilament at least is more transparent than braid is.
Mm-hmm.
But we've had a lot of bright sunny days out there, not so much with the overcast. And on a bright sunny day, monofilament's pretty easy to detect too. It reflects the light very well. And it looks, at least from above, almost like a shiny piece of metal.
Yeah, and a piece of tinsel.
That's almost as bad as having a wire leader. So right. What do you do instead?
Fluorocarbon. Fluorocarbon is probably the best answer for that. And you can also downsize it a little bit if you want to do that, if that makes you feel a little bit better. But fluorocarbon bends light, so it's virtually invisible underwater.
So basically what you're doing is when you look at monofilament and fluorocarbon side by side in the air, they both look like clear plastic.
Pretty much.
Look at them side by side in the water, the fluorocarbon still looks like clear plastic. The monofilament usually looks like metal.
Right.
So, yeah, if you want to hide it, then fluorocarbon is definitely the way to go. But Robert, fluorocarbon's so expensive.
It is. But if you're getting 50% more bites and catching more fish in general, isn't that worth it?
Well, think about how expensive it really is. I mean,
in the big scheme of things, it's one of the cheapest things there is besides the hook.
A 25 or 50 yard spool of fluorocarbon is how much?
30 pound, 25 yards starts at about $14.
Okay. That's really not that expensive when you break it down to I'm going to be using 2 or 3 feet of it as a leader material.
Right.
There's a lot of line on that spool.
Absolutely. And when you consider your rod and reels, let's say $200, gas is almost $4 a gallon, taking care of the boat itself is hundreds of dollars. The line's the pretty cheapest part.
It really is. And especially, like you said, if it helps you hook more fish, because every year, it gets a little bit trickier to go out there and hook fish. We've got more people here all the time. We've got fewer fish to go around. That's just the nature of it. When more people hit the water, there's just not going to be as many fish per person. So we also do a great job of educating our fish down here.
Yeah.
So
with the catch and release of them because of size limits, closed seasons, and just the nature of people just letting more fish go than keeping fish.
Yep. So if you want to go out there and catch fish, you've got to try to hide your presence from them as well as possible. And that doesn't just mean using a longer piece of leader that is less visible. It also means that your terminal tackle matters too.
Yeah. Smaller rod and reel.
Well, no, what's on the other end of your line? How many times have you seen guys want to go out there and use an 8-aught hook for a live shrimp because they're saltwater fishing and they need a big, strong hook for that big, strong fish?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you got to downsize your tackle all the way around. Definitely a big deal with that. Just match your hook to the fish you're, or to the bait you're using, not the fish you're going after.
And if you think that the hook is too small, well, take a look at some of the lures that are hanging on the shelf. Take a look at some Rapala plugs, which we use Rapalas all the time for catching pretty good sized snook, for catching big redfish. And the individual hooks on those trebles, how big are those hooks?
Pretty small.
They're nothing like the size of that 8-aught hook that people think they need for a shrimp. They're not even the 4-aught hook or the 3-aught hook or the 2-aught hook. It's more like a number 2 live bait hook.
Right.
It's a pretty small hook, and it'll hold those bigger fish.
Sure.
And does the same thing if it's not a treble.
And every one of them straighten out no matter what.
If you pull on it hard enough and you have the tackle that is able to straighten out that hook, then yes, you can certainly straighten out any hook.
Yeah.
You know?
I think there's only two hooks in there that I've never straightened out, and that's because one of them I've never used.
And the other
it's
one?
It's too new. It was a needle eye, or actually it was a welded eye hook that was made by, actually I think it was made by VMZ.
So a big game marlin style hook?
Pretty much.
Yeah, going to be hard to straighten that out. Not to say that you can't, but with hooks like that, that tend to be super tough, you actually are more likely to break it than you are to straighten it.
Right. So now a lot of guys have been going offshore fishing lately. Because the weather's actually been really nice. Hasn't been blowing too bad.
Finally had some late winds.
Yeah.
There wasn't so much sea fog.
Yeah, there's been a couple days of that, but it's been breaking loose, most of it. But it's been a lot of people asking questions about doing that, and every one of them has a different technique or was told to do a different way of rigging up for going out there to fish bottom fishing or also just plain old vertical fishing. Because this, some of these techniques apply to people who are fishing on piers. You know, because there's a lot of times we're fishing vertically.
Yeah, if you're fishing straight up and down, it doesn't matter if you're fishing straight up and down in 8 feet of water or 80 feet of water.
Right.
The technique is going to be real similar.
So what's the most common way that you would rig up to go out there to fish on any of the nearshore reefs for, let's say, the porgy, snapper, grunts, and sheep's head?
Well, I'll start with the most common way that I see it done, and then I'll tell you why I don't like it.
Okay.
The most common thing I see done is people will use a relatively short leader, something between 18 inches and 3 feet, and they'll put that leader on the end of a swivel.
Mm-hmm.
So they're connecting the main line and leader with a swivel. Above that swivel, they put an egg sinker. And that egg sinker will be somewhere between usually 2 and about 4 to 6 ounces. And while that style of fishing can work, the reason that I don't like it, especially for newbies, is that it makes it much harder to detect the bite. Most people don't realize that the average fish they're going to catch out here on the reefs, especially if you're fishing the nearshore reefs, is not going to be a 15 or 20 pound grouper. You know, you're not going to be able to detect the bite of these smaller fish that we're catching out there. And right now, a lot of what we're catching out there is sheep's head, which are notorious bait thieves. But the other things we're catching out there, mangrove snapper, lane snapper, porgies, mostly smaller fish, most of them less than 2 pounds, which they don't grab the bait and run with it. You know, it's not like a bite from a big grouper where he inhales it and then takes off. So you need to have a way that you're going to be able to feel what's happening down there at the end of your line.
And because that sinker's on top, you feel you can't feel it as easily?
You don't feel it as easily because you drop that line down to the bottom, and when you feel it hit bottom, now your sinker is laying on the bottom, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you just have a line that's going through that sinker. The line itself moves very easily through that sinker.
Right.
If I'm a fish, I can grab your bait and I can swim around probably a couple of feet before you even feel what's happening down there. You will have very little way of detecting a bite at all, even if you're fishing with braided line, which is more sensitive. So people lose a lot of baits that way. They lose a lot of potential fish that way. So what I do instead is I use what's called a porgy rig or a chicken rig or a high-low rig. And the main difference is that the sinker and the hook basically swap positions. instead of having the sinker several feet up above the hook, I want to put the sinker all the way down at the end of my line. And then I'm going to put the hook above the sinker. Now, I'm not usually going to put it several feet above, but 18 inches is about right.
Right.
And it's a pretty simple rig to tie. If you can tie a dropper loop, then that's all you really need. I put a dropper loop at the end of my line to attach a bank sinker to, which means that my sinker comes off very easily, goes on very easily, so I can change sizes, or I can go out there driving out to the reefs without a sinker, swinging around and hitting up against the inside of the boat, hitting up against my rod, doing damage to my gear. And then I tie another dropper loop about that 18 inches up above the first dropper loop, and that's where I put my hook. And again, because it's a dropper loop, I can put the hook on, I can take the hook off very quickly, very simply. So when I'm actually driving out to the reef, I don't have anything rigged on the end of my line. I just have two dropper loops. There's no hook to stick me. There's no sinkers slapping up against everything.
Basically, it's very similar to what they would call a perch rig for up north.
It is, or a drop shot rig, if that's what you're more familiar with.
Right.
And the advantage to it is that when we drop it down, the sinker sits on the bottom, and it keeps my line taut all the time. Number one, I can tell if my bait is sitting over sand or if it's sitting over the actual hard bottom that I want to be fishing just by tapping that sinker against the bottom. If it's tapping on rock, it feels very different than when it's tapping on sand. So that lets me know if I'm in the right position. Number two, I know that I have my bait positioned where I want it, just over the bottom, because my line stays taut while that sinker is up in the water, and as soon as it hits the bottom, my line goes slack. So if I hold it right at that position just before my line goes slack, I know that my bait is right at that 12 to 18 inches above the bottom where I want it to be. And of course, the big advantage, as soon as a fish starts tapping at the bait, I feel what's happening down there. And I can tell eventually whether it's a little fish or a big fish. You're not going to be able to tell that right at first. If you don't get the feel for it, you're not going to know that. All you're going to know is that something is happening with your bait. And then you can react to it. And the way you react to it is you just reel. You just turn the crank and right. Start pulling that fish up towards the top, or you miss the fish because it's just a little guy, or you miss the fish because he decided to stop messing with your bait when it moved, and then you just drop it back down to the bottom.
Or you yanked it too hard.
Possibly, but if you're just using the reel, it's hard to yank it too hard.
Right.
Most of the time.
Most of the
time. If you put the bait on there well.
Even when you know people who reel, like me personally, I reel at the same time as I'm lifting my rod, but I'm not yanking on the rod. I'm just slowly raising the rod up while helping it to maintain pressure as I start to reel to bury that hook.
Right. And that's because you have a little more experience with it.
Right.
For people who don't, I tell them just reel. Because what's going to happen is if that fish is there, they're going to feel the pressure. And when they feel the pressure, they're automatically going to raise the rod. They're not going to be able to help themselves. It's going to be basically an instinct to start lifting that rod up. So until they get a little bit of feel for it, I tell them just reel. Don't do anything but reel.
Now, one of the great benefits of this porgy rig that you're talking about is that when you're lowering your bait down, that sinker is always going first. But it's, pardon me, but it's on the bottom of your leader, right below your hooks. So it's pulling everything completely straight down with it.
Right, as opposed to what you get, as I call it, helicoptering.
Right.
Because when you have a sinker that is kind of in the middle of your rig, then that long leader wants to wrap itself around your main line, and that can cause real problems. Even if you don't have a lot of current down there, it still will want to wrap itself around your line.
Yeah, because the sinker is going to pull a lot faster and harder than the bait is, so the bait is going to stay above it while spinning on its way down.
Yep.
And just trashes your line. You know, you'll not trashes it, but you'll have a tangled mess most of the time.
You'll have a tangled mess, and then after you straighten it out, you're still probably going to have a tangled mess. Because it's going to do it again the next time you drop.
Right. Now, that being said, I know that you're making a loop out of it and tying it essentially like a uni knot or just a couple overhand clinch knots.
It's basically, I usually, for this type of fishing where we're on the nearshore reefs, I use a surgeon's loop. The surgeon's knot is one of the easiest knots that you can tie. I've taught the surgeon's loop to hundreds of people, including people with very bad arthritis, including people with very limited hand mobility, including very young children. And it's quite simple to tie. It really is.
Yeah. But you've got some of these other guys will micro-engineer it, and there is an offshore knot for making a heavier duty one of those rigs for grouper fishing. We teach a lot of rigs at the shop, but that is one that I've never been able to perfect.
The offshore knot?
Yeah.
It is a little bit more challenging to do. The problem with it is getting it snugged down pretty.
Right.
You know, it'll still work if it's not snugged down pretty. That's one of the great things about that knot, is that when you're tying a dropper loop, especially the dropper loop that attaches your hook, the way it fails is the dropper loop just pulls through, which means that you still have a hook. It's still attached to your line. You're still going to be able to catch the fish. You're just going to have to re-rig when you go to drop down the next time.
Right, because it tweaks it all out.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's one of the issues that some people have, and especially like fluorocarbon. Fluorocarbon is a much more rigid line because of the type of plastic materials that they use for it. It's just basically a harder line.
Yeah. And so, there are other ways you can tie this. I mean, I've seen people who have modified it so that they tie their hook on first using a uni knot and then just leave a really long tag end.
Sure.
And then they tie the sinker onto that. Okay. Same basic effect. I've seen people use a three-way swivel where they'll tie one end to their main line, one end to a short line that has a hook attached to it, and one end to a short line with a sinker attached to it. Same basic effect. I don't like using that method because I've seen a lot of those three-way swivels fail because most three-way swivels are pretty cheaply made. You know, if we're catching pompano, that's fine. But if we're going out there to reef fish and we have at least the possibility of catching something in that 8 to 20 pound range, I don't like using stuff like that that can break.
Right. And that's why I agree with you on that. But that's why I was bringing that up, because when you do get into some of those bigger fish, the standard porgy rig can fail.
Yeah, it can.
And that's the other reason why we don't sell like pre-made porgy rigs. We sell some of the metal ones. But the biggest drawback to some of your pre-manufactured rigs out there is that the majority of them are put together with crimps. And crimps and monofilament, especially mass-produced, not the best way to go.
No.
The other thing is a lot of these rigs are still hard to get just because of the materials involved. You know, you can't get one that's already got hooks on it, you know, because they just can't get the hooks. The other one is that because of costs and because it is kind of more niche-y, so to speak, you don't have a great deal of selections of those the way you would think. You know, there's not 40 different companies making a porgy rig. Most of the porgy rigs, or any pre-made rig for that matter, any of them that are worthwhile are from local made areas.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it's weird how, I guess weird's the wrong word, but people get flustered very easily when they come in and they're looking for this. You know, everyone wants that instant gratification, just be able to pull it out of a package, tie it on, and be ready to go. And they don't realize that, okay, are you fishing just for sheep's head? You don't need a circle hook. But if you've got a chance of catching mangrove snapper or porgies or any other reef species while you're out there, and you decide you're going to keep them, you need a circle hook. So manufacturers out there don't necessarily want to spend that money to put different styles of hooks and risk being illegal for the person, the consumer buying it. And that gets a little frustrating and daunting to some people too.
So what you're saying is you need some pre-rigged porgy rigs that you can sell in the shop? Because I'll come out with my own line of them.
Sure.
It'd be the easiest thing in the world, because tying up a porgy rig, I mean, out on the water, if I lose my porgy rig because we manage to snag bottom, which doesn't happen as often with porgy rigs as it does with other rigs, because your hook is up off the bottom.
Right.
And because you're using a bank-style sinker, which usually if it gets hung up in the rocks, it'll come out of the rocks because it's teardrop-shaped. It's easy to pull out of stuff like that. But I can go from having just the line to leader not tied and nothing but a piece of line dangling there to a complete porgy rig in about a minute. I mean, it's quick to tie.
Because you've tied it 1,000 times.
Yeah, but even people that I've just taught that surgeon's loop to can probably do it in 3 minutes.
Right.
If not faster than that. Yeah, it's quick.
Right. But it's surprising to me when people say, well, I just want it pre-made so I don't have to mess with it. And it's like, yeah, okay, I understand that. But making your own, A, you can dictate how much line you want for each one of those, whether you want that rig to only be 1 foot long or if you want it to be 4 feet long.
You can decide whether you want one or two hooks. You can decide whether you want the loop that the hook is on to be 6 inches long or 16 inches long, you know, because that does make a difference. You know, a short one, it's easier to detect the bite, but a long one can be to your benefit when the fish are being picky.
Right. You know, so a lot of times I'll make that decision once I get out to where I'm going, you know, rather than pre-making a bunch of them ahead of time. But I guess if you were going to pre-make them ahead of time, you want them ultimately to be about 3 feet long, I think, is a good overall length, wouldn't you say?
I think so, yeah. But I'm sensing a potential sideline gig here, and I need more sideline gigs.
Yeah, because you just have absolutely enough time for all of this stuff, don't you?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But the Captain Josh brand Porgy rig, I mean, that's really what you want, right?
Uh-huh, sure. Sounds good. It even rolls off your tongue just right to go with your other 12 hats that you wear. So what is another rig that's pretty common out there for going offshore?
Why don't you tell me another rig? Because I feel like I've been talking a lot.
You do all the time, though. That's just in your nature. It's all good. You know, the thing is like those are the two most common ones. And I think there is another rig called a knocker rig that a lot of people will talk about for going offshore.
Hate a knocker rig.
There is one benefit to a knocker rig. So we were talking about building the typical Florida rig, which is also anyone who's fished, it's basically a Carolina rig or also a river rig.
And you'll hear it called a slip sinker rig down here because the line slips through the sinker.
Yeah. So what a knocker rig essentially is you've got your main line, then you've got a swivel or a line-to-line knot. If you're going to do a line-to-line knot, I recommend you use also a plastic bead for your sinker on this one because it can your leader, let's see, line-to-line knot or swivel, leader, sinker, egg sinker, so your line is sliding freely on your leader, and then your hook.
So that maybe another bead and then your hook. Bead. Because the sinker does beat up those knots considerably. Because
it's sliding up and down against your main knots.
Every time. It's always butting up against your knots. Where at least with the slip sinker rig, because it's slipping through, it's not constantly beating up your knots.
Right.
But a knocker rig does.
Yeah. And then what you do is you put your hook on, and then essentially what you're doing is you're sliding or putting your bait down into the water and dropping to the bottom. And since your egg sinker is going to slide down to your swivel because the bait's going to pull slower, your swivel actually stops your sinker from keep going and causing your bait to helicopter as much. It will still helicopter and tumble on you, absolutely, but a little less. Then when it hits the bottom, your sinker is sitting there and your bait floats up off the bottom. Is the technique or what they want you to do. Personally, the regular Carolina rig and the knocker rig are both not the best. But if I'm going to make one over the other, I will do the knocker rig. Because what I've learned over the years is, let's see, I use like 4 to 6 feet a leader. I don't use 18 inches a leader. I make my leaders a little long. When going from point A to point B on the boat, you've always got your hook tied. Most people put it into the eyelet of their rod, which is the wrong place to do it.
But they do it anyway.
And then your sinker is hanging there, swinging freely, bashing against the boat or the blank of the rod as you're going out. Some people are smart enough to put it down and wrap it around the base of their reel and then keep that sinker down towards the bottom. The knocker rig I actually find, because my sinker slides all the way down to my hook, I just put it right down in the very bottom off of my handle, or if I've got a bracket, you know, the reel seat holder has a hole in it, I'll put my hook through that. So that way my sinker, any swinging it's going to do, it's going to bang against the foam part of the handle of the rod and not do as much damage. A lot of times with those grouper rigs that people make themselves with a sliding egg sinker, when we used to use mono, you used to be able to fix it in place to keep your sinker from sliding down faster down your line. You would take a split shot and put it a few inches above that egg sinker to kind of hold it in place while you were lowering it down. With braid line, that doesn't work very well.
Because a split shot just doesn't hold. The diameter is too small.
Yeah. Even if you smash it with a pair of pliers, half the time it works its way loose. It just slides up, slides down with it. With the knocker rig, you can actually slide that egg sinker up to your swivel if you want it to be fixed in place and just put a split shot right below it, and now you've got your sinker holding right into place.
So the reason that I hate them, all the disadvantages of the slip sinker rig plus an extra one, which is especially noticeable if you choose to crimp your sinker into place using the method that you just described, which is that the fish will almost always be able to feel the weight about the same time or before you're feeling the bite.
Right.
So because of that, I mean, again, we're dealing with a lot of educated fish, even on the reefs. I mean, how many people are out there and you hear the complaints all the time, oh, all the grouper we caught were 14 inches or 16 inches or 19 and a half inches and we had to put them all back. A lot of these red grouper are getting caught when they're young, sometimes more than once. So anything that puts them wise to the thing that happened to them before, where they were abducted by aliens, that's us, you know, I want to avoid it.
Right.
So at least with the porgy rig, yes, the fish is going to feel some resistance because the line stays taut all the time. But I feel him as he's feeling me. Yeah. So it gives me the advantage.
Right.
And the other thing about the porgy rig is when I start reeling, because I'm pulling the bait away from that fish, a lot of times with smaller fish, they just let it go because they don't have the confidence to go after it. But with bigger fish, they don't like seeing dinner disappear. So a lot of times bigger fish will grab it for real before it goes away. And that's how you end up going from a tiny little tapping nibble to suddenly a good size fish on your hook when you start reeling. And it happens very quickly. And with those other rigs, you just don't get it. You can develop a feel for the other rigs. I know people who hate the way that a porgy rig feels, who just can't do it because they learned the other way first and they developed a feel for it through trial and error over time. It's the same as those guys who can't stand spinning reels because they grew up with bait casters, and they can't stand those magnetic bait casters that are anti-backlash because they grew up with the dead simple ones that will backlash in a split second for most of us.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that their method is better. It means that they developed the feel for that method, and so now they've grown to love it. You, who probably are a beginner or closer to a beginner than they are anyway, you need a method that's going to be as easy for you as possible. Because let's face it, I mean, our average person moving down here to fish is probably already in their late 50s to mid 60s. And they don't have a lifetime to come down here and learn that feel and get that experience. They need something that's going to let them catch fish now or as close to now as possible.
Well, and that just reinforces this next statement, is that you've got to remember that these people that you personally, because, I mean, how often do we go out with friends or acquaintances that we're teaching about fishing? We've got to assume... Yeah. We sometimes forget, but most of the time we got to treat it in the aspect of, let's make this as simple as possible for them. Because even though I might fish it with, let's say, a standard grouper rig and have that technique where I'm stubborn and say, yes, this works great for me and that's why I hate the porgy rig. But if I'm going to teach somebody, I'm probably going to teach them the porgy rig method because I know it's going to be easier for them to pick up and understand and get the feel for it.
Right.
Even though I'm more successful the other way, but I just know how much easier it is for that learning curve. And I want them to build their confidence for going out and having a good time. So they'll hopefully fish with me more often, or in my case, they're going to come back to the shop and hopefully buy more stuff because they were so successful at doing what we taught them to do.
And teaching those simple methods, I mean, it doesn't mean that we don't teach them the more complex ones later. If they master them and they come back and they say, well, you know, show me something that's better than this, because this does work, but there's got to be something better. Okay? I might show somebody the FG knot for connecting line to leader, but I'm not going to teach it to somebody who's at the beginning of this. Somebody who is just getting started doesn't get the FG knot. They get a double uni knot, and maybe they even get a surgeon's loop, because the surgeon's loop is the simplest way that I can show them to connect a line to leader together. Now, I personally don't use the surgeon's loop unless I have lost a leader and I need to tie one as quickly as possible. I don't use it because it's a big clunky knot. It sits off to the side instead of in the middle, and it's not a very strong knot. But it's definitely better than them trying to do something that they're not going to be able to do and getting frustrated and saying, well, forget this, I'm just going to go play golf. Right. So I'll show them the simplest method that works, and if they get interested and they get more into it and they say, well, that's easy, okay, then here's a more complex way that you could do it that works better. And if you find that to be easy, okay, well, here's a method that's really complicated and maybe works better than anything else, but if you get it wrong, you're going to be super frustrated all the time and you're just going to want to quit. So right. I'm not going to start out with that. I'm going to start you at the beginning. I'm going to teach you to add before I teach you long division, before I teach you calculus.
That's a good way to put it. So if you were going out this weekend, we'll change the subject here since you also just did the paper a couple days ago and talked to a lot of different people. What are you hearing about snook fishing out there in the harbor?
Most of what I've been hearing is actually fairly slow.
Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of the snook have moved up into the backcountry, and the ones that are coming back out have not been really in a strong feeding mood yet. Now, that may have changed since we did the last reports.
Right. Well, it's changing daily right now because of the warm weather.
When it's 90 degrees every day, you know, things are going to change quick.
Yeah.
But, you know, snook is not what I'm super excited about right now.
What is the one you're super excited about right now?
Spanish mackerel.
Why are you super excited about a little Spanish mackerel?
You know how much I love them Spanny Macs. They come in, and they come in schools, and they come in hungry. And it's a way, way underrated table fish, too. Mostly because people either hear the word mackerel and just assume that it's going to be like Jack mackerel or like Boston mackerel, or because people have been told that it's not a good eating fish. They don't realize that it actually is.
Well, but one of the main reasons for that is, I mean, the number one reason for that is you already explained that. The guy who told them that Spanish mackerel is no good is because he has tried the Jack mackerel or the Boston mackerel.
Right. Or, more likely, somebody told him
right.
that mackerel are no good.
It was just all a big folklore thing, but you know, we talk about it all the time with any of your fish you're going to keep here. What's the number one thing that people screw up, especially with Spanish mackerel?
They don't put them on ice.
Or they don't put them on enough ice.
You got to ice your fish, and you got to ice them like you mean it. You know, yeah. If you go in to buy fish at a fishmonger's or even at a seafood counter, and you see the fish laying there on just the bare surface, are you going to think, oh, that's some fresh fish right there?
Right.
No, you're not.
No.
You want to see those fish laying on a deep, thick bed of ice. You want to see them as chilled as possible. And yet, the same guy will go out there and catch Spanish mackerel and stuff them in a 5-gallon bucket or throw them in his live well full of 80-degree water and expect them to stay perfectly fresh for the 5 hours that he's out there on the water.
Right.
That's not how that works. That doesn't happen that way. And then he goes on Facebook and he asks, why was my Spanish mackerel so mushy? You know? Well, you did that. You know? It's a soft-fleshed fish compared to some other species. You know, nobody's ever going to mistake Spanish mackerel for grouper, but it's firm enough that you're not going to have a problem with filleting it, you're not going to have a problem with cooking it, you're not going to have a problem with eating it, as long as you've treated it correctly from the very beginning.
Yeah, that's the biggest thing with all of them. And, you know, another thing that you can do is do a slush mixture.
Slush is great.
You know,
slush is easy.
Very easy.
You can just take a couple of bags of ice, dump them into whatever container you're using, whether it's a cooler or your insulated fish box or, you know, in a pinch, that 5-gallon bucket.
Right.
And then just add some nice clean salt water to it.
Right.
And that will create a slush. That slush will lower the body temperature of your fish very, very quickly. Not only does it kill them quickly and humanely because they die of hypothermia, and hypothermia is a great way to go, but it also pulls a lot of the fish's blood into the organs, into the parts of the fish that we're going to throw away, and your fish fillet will be nice, firm, and probably white instead of pink when you go to actually process those fish. It's a great way to deal with them. And if I'm going to go out there and harvest Spanish mackerel, then that's definitely what I'm going to do, because I see it way too often where people will end up with fish that are basically inedible because they didn't do that. They didn't know how to treat those fish. You know, another thing you can do, and not just with Spanish mackerel, but with any of those species out there, is you can bleed them out. If you cut the fish roughly between the gills and you sever that artery that connects the gills and the heart, which, remember, gills are the equivalent of lungs in us. There's a big artery that connects those two things. And if you sever it, then you can exsanguinate that fish pretty readily. You can get most of the blood out of the body. And combining those two methods, bleeding plus slushing, will probably result in the best quality fish.
Of any species.
Any species at all. Even those fish that are traditionally white-meated fish. If you think that snook tastes as good as it possibly ever could, you know, the next time we have a snook season, which could be this year, could be next year, or
whenever.
Could be when your grandkids grow up. I don't know when. But if we do eventually have another snook season and you harvest one, bleed it and
right.
See if that meat is not whiter, firmer, cleaner, better tasting than what the last one was.
Yeah, that's literally any species. And since the most popular ones around right now are the Spanish mackerel showing up, trout, mangrove snapper, and the sheep's head.
And red grouper. You know, so many people, when they're offshore fishing on the bottom, forget about that. You know, well, a red grouper or a snapper is a white-meated fish. Well,
right.
Okay, bleed it anyway.
Yeah.
Give it a shot.
Yeah, you'll be really, really surprised.
The only downside to bleeding is the mess. And I tend to want to bleed either into the cooler or into a bucket, because especially if you're anchored in one spot, bleeding over the side will have a tendency to draw in some unwanted competition.
Right. No, that's true.
You're chumming for sharks,
yeah.
Basically, when you bleed over the side.
Yeah.
But that can work to your advantage, too, especially with having the Spanish mackerel move in, because as they come in, so do the sharks.
Yeah.
So if you've caught 5-6 Spanish mackerel, you have enough for dinner now, well, now we can take that bucket of Spanish mackerel blood and we can pour it into the live well and let the pump start trickling that stuff out and see if we can't chum a shark or two up and just extend the fun.
Now, another thought process on that Spanish mackerel being a little soft was maybe he thawed it out. Maybe he actually froze that fish.
Maybe he did. Maybe he did. And that is not a fish that you really want to freeze. Like I said, we got 5 or 6 mackerel, and that's enough for dinner for tonight. And it's really all I want to take. Unless I'm going to give a couple of fish to somebody else for dinner for tonight. But it's not dinner for tomorrow. It's definitely not dinner for 3 weeks from now after I've put it in the freezer and thawed it out, because Spanish mackerel just doesn't take it.
No, it's one of the few fish that does not do well freezing, and a lot of people forget that or just don't know that. So just take what you think you're going to eat today and tomorrow, not freeze it at all, just keeping it as cold as possible. For the next day, it's okay if you keep it as cold as possible.
Yeah, it's okay.
Right.
Now, mackerel can be frustrating for some people because they are toothy fish.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of people will want to fish for them with wire leader. And as we mentioned, our water's really clear. Mackerel have great vision. They're extremely fast-swimming predators. They see the wire. They know the wire is there. And a lot of times it will really cut down on your strikes, especially if you're fishing with something like a shrimp or a bait fish that's just kind of out there on a free line or underneath a float, which they'll hit that. But when they hit it, they tend to take it a little bit deeper. And when they take it deeper, they tend to cut your line.
Bite you right off.
So the solution to that that I've found works best is instead of fishing with natural baits, instead of fishing slow or still, is to fish an artificial lure that never stops moving. Now, a lot of people who are used to fishing jigs or spoons will be very used to a pause and then retrieve method where you let it drop or let it sink, pick it up, start reeling it, and then let it drop again. And that works really well for Spanish mackerel, except that they're almost always going to hit it as it drops, and they're going to do the exact same thing they would do with your bait. They're going to cut you right off. Keep it swimming, and what you're going to do is you're going to get that fish to hit the lure a different way. When a mackerel goes after a moving bait, their most common tactic is to bite off the tail so that it stops moving. And when they go to bite off the tail from your spoon or from your jig, they end up with the hook.
Right.
And that's a great way for you to hook them, because then the hook is in the mouth, and the mouth is now far enough away from the line because you've got a whole lure in between them that you're less likely to have that fish bite you off. But I still suggest that you get that fish to the boat as quick as you can, because if there are other mackerel around, they'll try to take that lure out of the fish's mouth, and then that's the one that will bite you off.
Right. Now, right now, a lot of those Spanish mackerel that are showing up are mostly, almost all of them are pretty much in the intercoastal or the passes and right along the beaches.
Yeah.
People who are thinking they're going to go into Charlotte Harbor and put in at the 41 Bridge and go out and fish for them, not a chance.
Well, I wouldn't say not a chance.
Very, very, very slim
chance.
It's
just a lot less likely.
And same way with that Eljo bean.
Look to see if you have bait around. You know, if you have bait around, then those fish may have come up into the harbor with that bait. And that will start to happen more commonly here in the coming weeks, where
that's a bold statement.
It'll happen because the tide will bring bait in, and the mackerel are following the bait as they go.
Unless
the mackerel
get another major cold front.
Well,
that can change things significantly, because we're still just the very end of February, beginning
right.
of March.
We've
got
right.
at least one more cold front coming.
I have a May mindset because it
know.
Feels like it out there.
Exactly. The thing is,
okay, if the weather doesn't change, it will happen.
Yeah, you're just better off concentrating your efforts for realistic chances right now, as of this day along the intercoastal and along the beaches, whether it's from Venice all the way down through to Fort Myers, I think is going to be your best bet.
Well, and most of what we've been hearing about have actually been from guys who are going to the near shore reefs and look for sheep's head.
Yeah.
Because they're the ones who are finding the schools of glass minnows that are out there off the beaches. And we're talking, you know, not too far off the beaches, still within sight of shore for sure, but 3 to 5 miles out.
Right.
We're not fishing from the beach.
No.
Not yet.
Now, the other fish that have been going on out there that they have been catching with some regularity has been out along the beaches, both for the boat fishermen and for the land-based fishermen, has been pompano and bonnethead sharks. I'm hearing of bonnetheads and pompano being caught just right 100 yards off the beach there at Middle Beach or Blind Pass in Inglewood.
Mm-hmm.
And those are boat guys that are fishing out there just on the outside edge of the sandbar in like 4 to 5 feet of water. But then the guys who are walking the beaches are catching them right up against the shoreline.
And the same thing is happening at Casperson and to a lesser extent at Stump Pass. And I heard about some caught off Cape Costa.
Yeah.
So makes sense. Usually when it starts happening along our coast, it's happening all up and down.
Yeah. So that's been a fun one. The trout fishing has been the tough one. I mean, the biggest thing is most people have been coming into the shop are used to wintertime fishing and wondering why the fish aren't here, because our winter has been screwed up and you've got May on your mind with how warm it is. Almost all of our bass fishing is still along as close to the intercoastal as possible for whatever species you're looking for.
And seagrass have been tricky, or sea trout have been tricky. See, I got the grass on my mind
because right.
that's been the problem, is the lack of grass in the upper harbor has definitely contributed to a lack of trout in the upper harbor.
Yeah.
Those two things are tied together. So if you want trout and that's the fish that you would plan to target, you need to find yourself some good, healthy grass,
which
mostly means that you're looking a little bit further south. You're looking down towards Pine Island Sound.
Fleming Bay, basically intercoastal more than anything else.
Yeah, but it needs to be good, healthy grass.
Yeah.
You know, you can't have a bunch of algae growing on it. You can't have that real short, sparse stuff. That's not going to be enough to hold a trout. If your grass is only 3 inches high, then that's not it. That's not where those fish are going to be.
Right, exactly. If you do want to stay up into the upper end of the harbor, or going up into the Peace River or the Myakka River, they have been getting a few juvenile tarpon this week. With it warming up, few people have been seeing them up there. The juvenile tarpon on the Myakka River have been more close to the 41 Bridge area. And then on the Peace River, they've been up above Harbor Heights and even up into Shell Creek.
If it stays warm for another week, I think we're going to start to see some more adult-sized tarpon in those same locations.
Right.
Because we do have some fish in the river right now. There's always some adult tarpon that overwinter in the river.
Right. Yeah. And they usually start to chew sometime in March. Yep. So, yeah, that wouldn't surprise me at all if they start cooperating a little bit earlier than normal. Now, there are a few sharks around. You know, there's been those bonnet heads that we were talking about, but with these Spanish mackerel showing up, you should see some of the sandbar sharks moving in from offshore, possibly a couple black tips or spinner sharks, because it is the right time of year more for the spinners than it is black tips. But
yeah, but black tips are notorious for following those mackerel. So if we get the mackerel move in serious numbers, because right now it's just kind of, oh, there's some mackerel. You know, it's not like we can go automatically target those fish. We're not at that point yet. But, you know, if they really start showing up, which I'm expecting them to do, I think the black tips will be just behind them.
Right. And for anyone going offshore, which is what I would suggest because of the nice weather over the next, basically the long range forecast for the week shows it to be pretty nice. Go out there to, well, I don't care if you're just new to fishing, go 5 to 10 miles out, fish a lot of those near shore reefs or the smaller stuff, or run out there to that 30-mile range in, you know, 90 feet of water. There's been some cobia out there. There's reports of some bonita schools out there. If these Spanish are around, it's very likely that there could be some king mackerel that moved in, so go out there and take advantage of that. So,
and if you're bottom fishing, make sure that you've got that flat line too.
There you go. Well, we hope to see you guys next week. And if you have any questions, stop down and Fish and Frank's and check us out and we'll help you out.
Yeah, buddy.